Awesome to welcome Justin Wetzel to the Basketball Podcast. Wetzel is currently associate head coach, offensive coordinator for the Noblesville Boom, the NBA G League affiliate of the Indiana Pacers. He's coached in the G League with organizations including the Bucks, Rockets, Wizards, and Pacers. As head coach at Dickinson State from 2014 to 17, he led the team to the 2017 regular season championship. Earlier, as associate head coach at Montana State, he helped the program win its first GNAC tournament title and NCAA berth, plus key signature wins. He previously served as the youngest head coach in U.S. pro basketball with the CBA's Butte Daredevils and as an assistant player personnel director with the Great Falls Explorers, while also coaching at the high school level. Wetzel has balanced a career in coaching and is here to be able to share the game with us. Hey, coach, brief interruption from your podcast to hear from one of our top supporters, Hoopsalytics. Is your starting lineup not performing to your expectations? What if your star player is injured? Who should you play together instead? You can answer questions like this using the powerful Hoopsalytic basketball platform to reveal your most productive players and lineups. Just ask the AI assistant, and based on extensive player and lineup stats and analytics, you'll get accurate, data-driven answers instantly. You can literally ask anything about teams and players and then start making even better strategic decisions. Hoopsalytics also provides top-tier video link stats with a 12-hour turnaround time, as well as handy visualizations, interactive shot charts, coaching stats, easy-to-create film sessions, and lots more. And unlike the alternatives, you get unlimited video storage with no hidden fees. Best of all, Hoopsalytics is more affordable. Now in year 7, Hoopsalytics is a true game changer for thousands of basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball and start using advanced stats and AI to win more games today. Coach Wetzel, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Pleasure.
Pleasure to run into you in Summer League and a bunch of different places through our time together. We've run into each other and now we finally get to dive deep and share it with everyone else. I know one of the phrases that I love that you shared with me is this concept of being a CEO of their own development. Talk to me about that, Coach.
Yeah, it's something that I've developed over the years since I was a high school coach when I started, and it may not have had the complete vision and the actual structure it has now, but it's something I've always tried to do, and I've modified it along the way and tweaked it along the way, but the one thing that's always stayed true to the core is it's a player-led approach, and I try to keep it simplified within four steps, essentially. Again, through all the tweaks, all the places I've been, really try to keep it a player-led approach, and that starts with, like anything, if everyone wants to have control of their own destiny, right? Everyone wants to feel like they're controlling their own outcomes to a degree. And that's really the basis of it. I can get into the specifics of the steps. It being a player-led approach, the first step is involvement without the player, meaning one thing I think is completely underrated for a coach to do, and I've been guilty of this, is understanding your own player's strengths and why they're in your organization or why they're in your program or why they made the varsity team. So really the first step for me, and it varies being an assistant or the times I've been a head coach. And before I get too deep into this, sometimes I've been in an organization where we've adopted this as our overarching player development method. Sometimes I've just done it on my own with the 3 to 4 guys that I've worked with. So it takes a lot of shapes, but what I'm getting at is the first step really is understanding why this individual player is in your program. What are their strengths? Doubling down on their strengths. And using the word expectation. So I need to know what the expectation is for the organization for this particular player we brought in. What are the expectations for the head coach? What is the head coach expecting of this player?
So once you've got that information from the organization, how does that translate into the actual conversation with the player?
So I'm going to take that data, that knowledge gained in that meeting, and sometimes it's formal, sometimes it's just having a conversation within your program or organization. And when I meet with the player, that information is going to lead the meeting, but the player is going to be in charge of that said meeting. And I usually task them to come to me with 2 to 3 goals for the season. And that information we gathered in step one, that's got to guide their goals as well. Because specific to the G, everyone wants to score their way out of the G League, right? I'm going to score my way to my next contract. But if I know what the organization's expectation is for this player, if we're asking him to be a playmaker, and he comes to me in my individual player development meeting and says, I want to average 30 and do all this, and I have to help. That's part of being the coach. I have to help serve him in what's best for his expectations within the organization. You want to be on the floor? This is what they're looking to do. So I challenge the athlete with 2 to 3 specific goals they have to have, and they have to be measurable, Chris. Try to avoid subjectivity. For example, hey, I want to be a better shooter. That's great. Now let's get into specifics. I'll give you a real world example here. I had a player, I want to shoot 40% from three. Okay, that's great, but why? And I challenge them because players at my position and came into the where how I came into the league that shot 40% or plus in year two, they got better contracts. They got a two-way, they got a full E10, they got a better deal overseas. So when you're tasking your player to develop his own player development plan, and that starts with his own goals, you have to challenge him with the why and the specificity of it, meaning I want to shoot 40% from three because it's going to lead to a better opportunity for me and it's going to help our team because that's the expectation from the organization is for me to be a 40% three-point shooter. So there's an example, right? We got his goal established, shooting 40% from three.
How do you turn that into something the player can actually work on day to day?
And goal is performance-based, right? So now we have to attach a behavior that's going to match that performance. And I refer to those as standard. What's the standard that's going to support your goal? 40% from three is your goal. I look at this specific player I'm giving you an example of, and I look at you shot 43 on catch and shoot shots last year. That's already higher than the goal you already want. You shot around 34% off shots off the dribble. So our standard, and he's leading this, we're working through this together, but that tells me you probably need to increase your catch and shoot opportunities and decrease your off the dribble threes because catch and shoot opportunities, you've already met your measurable goal. So here's the standard, right? We're going to shoot, and we use data, and it's you don't have to be a math major to come up with these standards and goals. And it's for this specific athlete, it was simple. 70% of your shots have to be catch and shoot. And how do we do that? What's behaviors that we got to run to the corner? We got to play in space. We got to do all those things that are going to, we got to have an elite level of understanding of our concepts, our plays. And that's going to lead to more catch and shoot opportunities, which you've already proven you're shooting at a high clip. And that's going to help you. That's a standard or a behavior that's going to help you match your goal, meet your goal.
And what happens when a player doesn't live up to that standard?
Step one is gathering the data within the organization on the expectation. Step two, establishing 2 to 3 goals with your athlete. And step three is establishing a standard that matches that goal. And to me, the fourth step in all that is applying a consequence. And that can be a scary word, especially at the pro level, consequence, right? But you have the freedom to have your own goal. You have the freedom to even have your own behavior. But none of us are really free of consequences, right? So, and to me, this is really the simplicity. But what I've always found the real special part of this is how can I help you live up to your standard? Meaning, when you don't live up to your standard, how do you want me to coach that? What's the consequence you want to create for yourself? I'm not creating it. Now, we can talk through it. And the one thing that's important when I go back to the goals is, I'm backtracking a little bit here, but it's important to double down on strengths and the goals is a really important piece. Too many times we want to look to weaknesses. And that goes back to that first step of amongst the staff. What do our guys do well? As coaches, we always find out easy what our guys don't do. Our athletes are going to naturally gravitate to, man, I got to get better at this. And I try to stay away from, I got to get better at, and look at, we need to expand this area of your game. Because there's a fine line between ambition and not feeling like you're enough, right? We want guys who are ambitious, but we don't want them to feel like they're not enough. So when you establish a goal, that's important. The behavior and the standard need to match that goal, but also the consequence needs to match all that, right, too. Because initially, I've coached guys who they want to have a real extreme reaction. Just take me out of the game and don't play me. That sounds good now in an isolated air-conditioned office, you know what I mean? But when the heat is on and you create a consequence that is maybe an overreaction and it isn't matching your standard or your goal, that's probably not going to work out. So for this specific case I'm talking about, want to shoot 40% from three. Therefore, we want to take at least 70% of our shots or catch and shoot. He gave me the permission as a consequence. If I take back to back off the dribble, which you deem, coach, I'm giving you the freedom to deem that a bad off the dribble shot, take me out of the game and we can have a conversation, all those things. Now, there's idiosyncrasy to this. End of the shot clock, he gets handed a grenade, he's got to shoot it. I've got to be able to be smart enough as the person helping him, accountability and consequence to delineate between those things. But, and the last, the one point to this consequence portion is it's got to match the standard and the goal, because there may be some coaches out there, and I was guilty of this. I'll take a behavior example, right? And I'm speaking more college level. Kid missed class, right? That was a standard and a behavior that he failed to do. The next morning, I'm going to get him up and get him in the gym and run him. And I did that, right? I did that as a coach. We're going to punish him. He didn't go to class. We're going to run him. We're going to run him. And I started running the guys who, man, they wanted to be in the gym. They wanted to be conditioning, and the punishment didn't fit the crime, if you will. So the one thing I did when I was a small college head coach, I started doing a Friday night study club. If you missed a class, I'm going to communicate with that professor and find out what we missed that class. And Friday night, you're going to be in the office with me, and you're going to have your nose in a book, and we're going to be studying. My point to that is, your consequence has to match your standard and your goal, right? And so our consequence for this specific action was, you're taking too many off the three dribbles. One of the consequences of us got to pull you out of the game might get you right back in, but we're going to talk about it. Another consequence we had for this specific example was too many off the dribble threes. Okay, the next time we play live in practice, these are the strength constraints you talk about often is, we're going to have a no dribble day. Everything you shoot has to be catch and shoot. So again, you got your goals, you got your standards and your consequences. And if this hopefully is connecting with folks, but if it's not, another phrases I like to use for these three components is, goals is your motivation, standards is your behavior, and consequences essentially your accountability. And to me, those work from a player development standpoint. It's led by the player. And one thing this does, I've had a lot of experience where it's a player-led approach, they create it, but it also averts a lot of conflicts, right? I've had some athletes where we've created these things and I got to hold them to their consequence that they created. And they may look sideways at me and I simply say, hey, you created this. You're the one that wanted me to hold you accountable. And then it turns into maybe a smile and those kind of things. So this can help just bridge that communication gap. And as a coach, it forces us to listen. 70% of communication is listening. So as you're telling your athletes their goals, how they want to build these things, and how they want you to coach them when they don't live up to their standard, you're listening a lot when that's a form of communication. And it averts a lot of conflict. It's not foolproof.
Does this approach work even when the goal is something less measurable, like attitude or professionalism?
I'll give you a quick example. I coached a guy in the G, high level player, and could it, one of those guys where talent wise should have been an NBA, a standard contract NBA guy. And we sat down and I talked to him and I said, what's something I can help you work on this year? And he said, everyone tells me I got to be more professional. That's the feedback I keep getting from agents, from coaches. I got to be more professional. That's hard to measure, right? So we got creative and we basically talked about, let's work on, what does that mean to you being a pro? And one of the first things he said was, it means being a good teammate. All right, let's focus on this. Your goal is to be a better teammate, right? And so the standard that matches that goal, the behavior that's going to match that goal is, sometimes when things aren't going your way, you separate yourself from the team. That's what I've noticed coaching you for a couple of years. When there's a timeout and you're not happy with your performance, you're going to go to the end of the bench and separate yourself. So your goal is to be a better teammate. Let's create a standard where you're in every huddle. Before practice, we huddle. After practice, we huddle. Every timeout in the game, you're in every huddle. You're dapping someone up. You're engaged. That's not only going to have the perception of you being a better teammate, it's also going to, by nature, make you a better teammate. And so the consequence that was, and this is the example of getting where it can avert some conflict, is that we ran into a situation where he was upset during a timeout. He runs to the end of the bench. I make eye contact with him. He knows exactly why I'm making eye contact with him. He gives me a smile. He runs back in the huddle and it joins the huddle. So the consequence we had was when you are not in a huddle and you're disengaged, the next opportunity that I'm shooting with one of your teammates, you're going to rebound. So that's that point of the consequence has to match the standard. The standard is to be in every huddle and to be a good teammate is the goal. The consequence is post practice, when I'm getting shots with someone, you're going to come rebound for a teammate. That's going to make you a better teammate. And no one needs to know. That's why you're doing it. You're just naturally becoming a better teammate. And I know I can get a little long-winded there, but this is something that I'm passionate about, and I'm excited to keep growing it and building on it.
Justin, such good stuff. Let's dive deeper into each of the components. Now, you shared this document with me, which gives me a great outline of this, the pyramid. So, the base of the pyramid, let's just start with that. They have ownership in the planning process. How do you start that with them?
Yeah, like I talked about, it starts with you as a staff really establishing what the expectations for them are. By the time you get with them to meet with them, you already know why they're in your program, why they signed with you, why they made the team. The ownership portion is really putting them in a position to establish 2 to 3 goals that are going to help lead their development process. They have to take ownership in that. They have to tell you why they want to become a better shooter, and it has to be specific, it has to be measurable. They're really taking the lead in it. They're establishing all components of the developmental process, meaning the goals, the behavior, and the consequences that can lead to all that. Because it's like anything, we all want to control our own destiny, like I'd mentioned. And if they have ownership in it, they're just going to be more committed to it. I was guilty in the past of, hey, this is what we're going to work on. This is what you need to work on. This is what we're going to work on. And this is how we're going to do it versus taking less input from them. And the one thing that really clicked home for me on that part is just being at a level where guys really understand their own game, being at the pro level and understanding that they know what they need to work on.
So the base of the pyramid is that. The next part of the pyramid, which I think is one of the most important parts, is simplification of the plan, expectations in the role. So you talked about expectations, but making it easy to understand for the player and executable is really the art of this, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got to be people trust what they understand, Chris. And if someone can understand it, they're going to trust it. And I'm not smart enough to make it complicated, so it's got to be simple. And it's really just when we talk about the expectations and goals, it's really doubling down on their strengths. This is why you're here. This is why we have you here. We've communicated this as a staff, and here's the simple 2 to 3 goals or expectations we're asking of you. Again, this plan is designed to just really simplify in terms of goal setting, which is motivation, and standards, which is behavior, and consequence, which is accountability when you don't live up to your own standard that the player created himself.
Love it. And then the third part of the pyramid, we're moving up the pyramid, coaches, is allow for player feedback.
Yeah, you have to continually check in with your players, whether it's from a formal standpoint or as I mentioned earlier, is we all use the word communication so much, and we think of that as us just talking, and that's obviously a huge component of it. But as I'd mentioned, 70% of communication is listening. So you have to listen to your player, and you have to allow feedback for maybe there's an adjustment within the development. They're going to see far more than you do as a coach on the floor. Maybe it's an example of, man, I'm having a hard time making this read in the pick and roll. This is the coverage I'm seeing. So can we tweak this within the plan? You just have to have that open door policy, for lack of a better word, of just allowing player feedback in this process.
And of course, it comes all together in terms of the top of the pyramid, which is growth. So, talk to us about how you're measuring some of that growth with the player and for the player.
The goals that you establish, they have to be measurable. You have to avoid subjectivity. So that's really the easiest way to measure growth. But it's also process driven because sometimes the goals you set and the growth portion of it, that's predicated maybe on minutes and catches and shots, and maybe a player doesn't get the certain minutes or opportunity on the floor that allows for them to really take these measurable goals. So you have to identify that in practice, in film, and do a good job of charting and statting any scrimmage. How I view this plan of action in terms of development is if you're looking at like a cycle diagram, right? We think of growth and development a lot of times as a graph going up or an elevator. Success and growth isn't an elevator, it's a continuous pattern and a continuous flow. So I look at it as a graph of a pie chart of your goals, your standards, and your accountability consequences, and it's ever flowing, and one is growing the other. You're never just at the end of the elevator ride up the floor. It's continually flowing, continually growing. Your behaviors are going to help you grow your goals, and your accountability and consequences are going to help grow your and hold yourself accountable to your behavior. And that's just going to continually flow and grow and expand and measure that growth that way. But again, the growth part, that's why it's important to make these very measurable.
Incredibly important. And I think coaches are getting the idea. Obviously, this applies at all levels of coaching. And you've been very fortunate that you've had a chance to test this at all levels of coaching as well. So, a very practical way. And now, step by step, just to go through it so coaches can understand it, because I think it's a great conceptually and structurally way to think about things in terms of making players the CEO of their own development. As you said, player-led development, which is definitely the most important thing nowadays. So, in step one, we're establishing synergy within the organization regarding the player. You've talked about this obviously throughout, but what are some of the challenges that might happen in this step, and then some of the kind of ways to be able to counter some of those challenges?
Yeah, the big portion is whatever level you're coaching at, it's just getting everyone on the same page. And that usually, for most people, that's going to be what are the expectations of the head coach? At our level, it might be what are the expectations of the front office? Why did we sign this guy? But all that aside, whatever, wherever you're at, is you just got to get on the same page in terms of this is why we brought this person into our program or our organization. And this is our expectations for him. We brought him here to do A and B really well, and he needs to get maybe a little better at C. But doubling down on the strengths is the big portion for me. And basically, step one and step two is, I again, as I mentioned, one of the most underrated things as a coach is really finding your players' strengths. I think that's so important. Oftentimes, it's easy for us to talk about what guys can't do, but it's important to just double down on their strengths, and that's going to lead this first step of the expectations of the athlete. Why is he or she in our program?
Just talking about that a little bit, that's something that shines through. Talking to coaches like yourself that spend a lot of time in the pro game is definitely like focusing on strengths more than developing weaknesses. And this is something that I've taken into my grassroots coaching a little bit, is to getting players to understand not that they can't develop these other things, but that they already do something well is one of the
Yep.
best ways to be able to develop a player's confidence. Is
No
understanding,
question.
hey, you already do this really well. Keep doing it really well, and let's lean into that. But that doesn't mean we're not going to develop these other things.
No question. That can maybe transition to the second step a little bit here. But as I'd mentioned before, when you're
Just the
talking,
second step, let's say it for coaches, communication with player to establish expectations and goal.
yeah, so you've taken that information from step one on what the expectation is for that player within your organization. And it's important to take that information. That has to guide step two, meaning when you sit down with your player and you're going to establish 2 to 3 goals, that has to match. But kind of going back to what you said earlier, oftentimes when you sit down with a player and you're going to say, what are your goals for the year? They're going to tell you everything that they don't do. And it's going to sound like, I need to get better at this, or I don't do this very well. And that goes back to helping a player understand their strengths and doubling down on those strengths. As I'd mentioned, it's a fine line between being ambitious and ambition and not feeling like you're enough, right? Oftentimes, guys are going to be ambitious and they're going to want to get so much better at the things that they deem weaknesses, and it's going to feel like they don't have enough in their game. But the reality is, you're here for a reason, and let's focus, let's double down on those strengths. So, what we like to do is, I challenge the player to come up with 2 to 3 goals that he wants to have for the season. And again, these goals, you got to make them measurable. They can't be subjective. You have to avoid subjectivity. And I challenge the athlete in terms of, hey, I want to be a better shooter. Let's get specific. I want to shoot, the example I like to give is a real world example of, I want to shoot 40% from three, and I'll challenge him why. Why 40%? And we've gotten to a lot of conversations where if I shoot 40% from three, where I'm seeing other guys at my position, that's a nice number where they've gotten better contracts. They've gotten fully tens, they've gotten a fully two-way contract. If I can shoot 40% from three, that's going to put me in this position in my career. But it's measurable and it's doubling down on his strengths. He's already a good shooter. We want to make him an elite shooter. Again, it's important to double down on those strengths when you're establishing those 2 to 3 goals.
Love that. And can you give us maybe like a high school or a college example of that? The G League one, the NBA one you gave. Is there something kind of equivalent of that at the younger level?
In terms of a goal.
Yeah, like a goal and then an example of like the measurability of the goal and then the obviously the growth of the goal.
Yeah, one of the ones that I go back to is from a college level. We had a guy who, when I was a college coach, who wasn't overly skilled and he wanted to get minutes, he wanted to play. And that's all subjective things, right? Hey, I want to play more. Let's really dive into this. Let's make a goal of maybe your strength isn't shooting or scoring, but you're going to be elite level rebound. And in your minutes, you're gonna average at least 3 to 4 rebounds in your minutes, right? You're a low minute guy. If you can average 3 to 4 rebounds a game, that's gonna hopefully put you in a position to increase your minutes. So there's a one where rebounding is a skill set at all levels, but that's one where maybe at a different level that often gets overlooked. So that's an example I've done at the college level in terms of rebounding. And there's been
It's
some.
a really good one because, as you said, like again, having been in the youth space for so long over the last few years, nobody values that, right?
No.
Only, and I've gone to saying this phrasing to players all the time when I do group clinics or sessions with them. And I just say, hey, listen, no parent will notice this, no social media will notice, but I want you to notice that, know that coaches notice this. And
Yeah.
that's kind of the most important thing to connect for them because the feedback often they're getting at the youth level, at the college level, and at the pro level is probably more from agents and family, but like you're
Yeah.
getting family feedback, and they're not necessarily the ones that are going to validate the things
Yeah.
that coaches actually care about, right?
Everyone knows scoring, right? I remember this as a high school coach, and the volleyball team's going to practice after us, right? And what's ultimately going to happen? One of those players is going to take a volleyball and try to shoot it in the basket, right? We all know scoring. That's an easy connector for us. And helping these guys, to your point, helping them find these idiosyncrasies and these intangibles. And that's why that first step is so important, is the expectation within your program. And a lot of times players that gets overlooked. They may not know why they're there. And here's the expectation from the head coach, or here's the expectation from the GM. I'm just telling you right now, this is what's going to get you on the floor and get you your opportunities. And sometimes they don't know that. As simple as that may sound, they may not know that.
We assume they know too much. There's no question. There's no question. I'll give you another quick example is my daughter's 15-year-old's probably about a 45% three-point shooter on higher on open shots. Doesn't get a ton of shots with certain teams she plays for, but a college coach mentioned, "Hey, she does a really great job holding space." And it's again, no parent, no social media would ever
No.
acknowledge that. But Justin with his player in the G League can give him examples of where this translates to that level.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Hey, coach, I'm excited to let you know that we just released a full 86-minute masterclass on how we developed youth players and teams in simple and easy to apply ways. These are the same methods that I used with local teams here in Los Angeles that have gone from getting beat by 30 to beating teams by 30. At Basketball Immersion, we coach kids for the long term, so they're still engaged, confident, and improving later in their basketball career. Not just winning games at 8, 9, and 10. When you join, you get access to a youth coaching masterclass that's transforming programs around the world, plus our full library of incredible ready-to-use resources and courses. This masterclass alone is worth the investment, and your players will thank you. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sales today to get started. So take us into the next step then. Step three, we help players create standards that match their goals. So you gave us a whole bunch of examples throughout this process. What happens when there's blowback? Like at your level from agents or from the player themselves or from different people that say, no, this isn't actually the goal we want.
Yeah, I think at my level, I don't deal with a ton directly with the agent. So that's why it's important in that first step to have an understanding with your front office of, hey, this is the expectations for the guy. When we sign this guy, this is what I talked about with his agent. He wants to develop more on-ball skills, so we gotta play him at the point guard a little more. That's why we were able to sign him here, so on and so forth.
And
You
is there a
know,
place for that whole expectation to change?
yeah, there's obviously, oh, this can morph, it can grow into things, things change. We're not doing this in a vacuum. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's perfect and it's never evolving. Yeah, for sure. And sometimes that's out of necessity, you know what I mean? In the G League, things change fast. You have a guy who's never played. We had a guy this year, for example, who was not a point guard, and out of injuries and necessity, he had to become a point guard. And so that we had to reevaluate. Absolutely. We have to reevaluate his goals and his expectations, and that's okay too. That's part of the process as well.
This is very interesting to dive into. And just to complete it so the coaches know if they're following along, the step four, establishing a consequence, a reaction, as you say, how do you want me to coach you when you don't live up to the standard? And you gave us tons of examples of this to be able to match the accountability and the consequence with that. Really good stuff just to bring it back home. Now, thinking of a coach, say, let's say a high school coach that's going to apply this four-step process. For them initially, are they coming up with their own conclusions or their own expectations prior to even meeting the player?
Yeah, that's obviously always encouraged. And the one thing that I learned just by trial and error of this, I would encourage any coach at any level that's going to maybe apply this, is you have to give it some time, meaning whether you may have to wait till you're a couple games into the season, because oftentimes we may start the season thinking this player is going to be our primary ball handler, right? And we get into the season and we understand, man, he's way better off the ball. So to answer your question, yeah, they're gonna work with their staff, or if it's a youth coach who doesn't have a staff, yeah, you may be building this on your own, the goals, but also you got to give it some time. It's okay to have some examples, have some games under your belt before you really sit and establish these expectations for your players. I don't know if that makes sense, but you have to give yourself some data and some reps as well to know your athlete.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. And I think at the end of the day, like how to turn kind of a vague goal into something measurable and player owned is ultimately the goal of this because that gives them more power over their performance and then their future possibilities, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Again, we all want to control our own destiny. We all want to feel like we're driving our own bus. And this is really what does that. And again, I mentioned it earlier, but this may be for maybe older, maybe you don't see this at the youth level as much, but I have it some stops along the way I've been. What it does is it really helps avert conflict as well. And again, I'd mentioned this earlier, but if you're establishing your goal and your behavior and it's player led, and when you don't live up to your standard or behavior, what's your consequence? How do you want me to coach that? It's hard to really fight back against that as a player and show frustration if you're the one that built this. You know what I mean? And I've had those direct conversations of, man, I'm doing this because this is what you created and I wanted what's best for you and we created this together. And oftentimes that helps alleviate any conflict in that manner. I really view this, Chris, as this can be, you can apply this to any goal setting in life, not just basketball. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. A great way to approach it and to think about it in those ways. What happens if a player is meeting the standard and we want to then increase the standard because they've done that over a set period of time? My fitness tracker, for example, I'm away in Vegas at Summer League. All of a sudden, I'm killing my goals every day. And then it comes back to me and says, hey, listen, do you want to increase your goal? Is that a part of this process?
So yes, it can be, and it can be a slippery slope too. So the big thing for me is I
I
always
couldn't agree more, by the way. I did not increase my goal with my fitness tracker because I know that was an outlier and not a consistent pattern.
Yeah, so an example I'll give is, again, I go back to the shooting example of percentage. Hey, my goal is to shoot 40% from three. I'm 20 games in, I'm 45% from three. That's important, but two things. I constantly make the player answer the why. Why do you want to increase it to 45%? Why do you want to increase it to X amount of rebounds? And they have to have a actual real example for me, because player A, B, and C are doing this, and this is where I want to be, or a real answer of why they want to do it. But also, I'm big on consistency, and this is the goal we set out, and this is why we set the goal originally at this, because oftentimes if you change the target, you lose sight of the behavior that got you there. And oftentimes, for example, the shooting, if a guy is shooting 45% and his goal was 40%, there's that confidence piece, right? He's feeling good. And now he increases his goal to now 46%, and he doesn't live up to that. That's going to really hurt a confidence standpoint. You know what I mean? I think that's something that as coaches, we have to. Sometimes you have to protect your athlete from themselves, and that's okay too. I mentioned that ambition. Ambition is a good thing, but also be a bad thing. So I'm big on, hey, let's win the marathon and not worry about the sprint today. So yeah, you have to really protect your athletes and being too fluid. And one example to that very point of, hey man, I feel like I've already maximized this goal of you don't want to be changing in the wind. I'm not going to change the plays every day, right? I'm not going to ask you to do two to three different offenses every week. So let's stay consistent in this and let's really master the consistency, and we can evaluate it at the end of the year.
And it's also okay to feel good about yourself, isn't it? That you're achieving your goal. And I think you know it more than I. In coaching, that's one of the hardest things to do, is to celebrate those moments where you're actually achieving your goals.
So confidence is really proven performance, right? I've always wrestled with, you talk to maybe a disgruntled player, man, coach, you took away my confidence. You're taking away my confidence. Maybe I've taken away your minutes, but what's your production within those minutes? Really, confidence is proven performance. So if you can prove that performance over time, that's going to naturally give you confidence. And there's nothing wrong with morale, right? There's a famous Navy SEAL. The guy who was killed Osama bin Laden, I read his book, and he made a in his book he talks about there's nothing wrong with making the troops feel good. And that's reality. It's okay to feel accomplished.
Love that. And I guess the other part that sticks with me is that you're giving me too much credit if I can take away your confidence,
Right,
right? And
that's a great point.
that's like another human being has control over you. That's a problem in and of itself. And brings me to one of these other points that I think shines through from looking through your document and hearing you talk about it, is that it's actually not the plan itself that's the power of this. It's the ownership, that the player feels the ownership of it.
And I've tried to, as I get older, you try to stay relating to young athletes I'm around every day. You got to stay modern. And I really look at it as it's not about the phone anymore. It's about the app, right? And this is really a app they can use and they can create on their own and they can constantly revisit. It's not about, like I said, making the phone call anymore. It's about the app on the phone. And that's how I really view this, is it's accessible, it's easy, it's always there, they can revisit it. And it's, again, they are controlling their own destiny. And that's, even from a human standpoint, that's really all we want, is the opportunity to have some control, especially in the G League, coach, where so much is out of your control. This gives you a sense of, man, I do have control over this. I can fall back to, I look at it like this. A goal is a performance base. When you fail at your goal, it's just an opportunity to try again, right? A standard is behavior base. When you fail at your standard, you fail at your behavior. So that's different, right? Now there's got to be a consequence for your behavior. So the thing is, when we talk about goals, if a player didn't hit his said goal for this game, I rarely talk about that. I talk about the behavior, and I hit that in film the next day of, Yeah, the reason why you didn't shoot a high percentage last night is you hardly got to the corner. That's the behavior, the performance is the shot. The behavior is getting to the corner, finding space to get you a good catch and shoot opportunity.
Such a great point there, just about the behavior and the importance of that. And the other thing, I don't know, maybe 6, 7 years ago, I started using the phrasing player led. I'm not sure who got adopted it from, but man, that is such a powerful tool to be able to just say that, to be able to help players understand that they're leading themselves in their development. And it's not the parent, it's not the teacher, it's not the coach, it's not me, et cetera, that they're responsible. And that individual responsibility is very empowering for a player, isn't it?
Yeah, it forces oftentimes when I do this, they know that they didn't live up to their standard before I even get to them. They understood, yeah, I didn't get to the corner on that one, or man, I didn't. That was a blow by on defense. And whatever they're choosing to measure and whatever they're choosing their standard is, they're going to course correct themselves. And that's really powerful. And this really, one thing that really hit home to me to your earlier point of them just having ownership is I coached a guy in the G League named Brandon Jennings. Most people know his name. And he was coming back. He had an Achilles tear. He went over to China. He was coming back. This is when I was with the Bucks G League team. And I knew that this guy's 10 plus year veteran. He's been playing professional basketball since he was 18. He famously went overseas out of high school. And I knew he knew his game. He knew his rhythm. He knew far better than I do. And I just went to him and said, "Hey, what do you need from me? What are three things you need from me?" And without me going to him with a formal, this kind of somewhat formal plan we're talking about, I just went to him in a casual manner of, "What do you need from me?" And he said, "I need to get in shape. I need to find my rhythm, and I need to find my confidence." So, taking those three areas, we help apply some things where if I saw him getting tired in a game, I was going to try to get him a sub. So, therefore, he didn't hurt his confidence and put him in positions, whether it's in practice, whether it's 3-on-0 reps, and then progressing to 3-on-3 reps to help get that confidence and help get that rhythm. That's one big point I learned specifically from him of, man, sometimes you just need to ask your athletes, what do you need from me? Because often we come all the time with, and it's our job to have those answers. It is. That's our job as a coach and a leader. But again, sometimes it's okay to ask, what do you need from me?
No, it's such a great point to be able to make them again active participants in the process rather than me predetermining or me telling them in advance what they need. Such great stuff and great conceptual way of thinking about it and structural way as well. Justin, I want to ask you because I know you have some unique thoughts on some of these things as well. Getting into some of the tactical stuff that you've been around in the game, I know you have a philosophy around random screening concepts. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I think we talk so much about corner spacing, which is obviously important, holding corner, and you're seeing that more at all levels, really. It used to be pretty specific to the NBA and Europe, but you're seeing so many people really go to the spacing-led approach. But how to play out of a corner, meaning those random screens. One thing I think, we were able to do a pretty good job at in the last few years is, for example, when that ball gets swung slot to slot, we are holding corner. But what if there's no swing opportunity? What do we have to do to find action, right? And apply pressure to the rim. A couple reads are if you're just can envision the ball getting swung slot to slot, you're in the corner, you don't have a one more catch and shoot, and your teammate receiving that slot to slot pass doesn't have a direct drive. One concept you're starting to see a lot more is these doorstep screens or scratch screens. You're reading out of the corner and there's no advantage to holding space. So you've got to create an advantage with the screen. You want to be there on the screen and you want to create some kind of advantage by being there on the screen early off that slot to slot pass because there was no advantage for a swing catch shoot or a stampede drive. Now, there's a couple ways when you're screening out of the corner. We all want to screen the bottom hip, create an over, but with teams switching, team doing different coverages. One of the reads we talk about, not only when to scratch screen, meaning when you don't need to hold space, but man, am I going to roll to the rim or am I going to go screen out? And a couple of things we talk about are if a team is going to switch, because one of the hardest things defensively switching is getting guys to come together and avoid point switching, right? Avoid guys getting underneath the switch, but oftentimes it happens. So we like to trigger a read of if I'm coming out of the corner to set that screen, that doorstep screen, if I see hips turn and hips open because they want to switch early, that triggers an automatic go screen out. We're going to go screen out. And because they've already predetermined a switch, that's going to hopefully create some chaos and cause an advantage. If we see the guy on the ball is going to, and with that being said, on the ball, anytime a ball, a screen, a doorstep screen is occurring, we're always thinking reject, right? Reject is one of the most, I think, under talked about things in terms of attacking pick and roll coverages. So we're always thinking reject, right? But if the athlete, if the defender is staying square and you don't see them open up to switch early, that's usually when we want to get a hit, right? If they're going to stay square, we want to get a low bottom third hit. And that's usually going to trigger a roll to the rim versus the go screen. And we really, again, you talk about constraints. I think one of the things that, just being able to watch Coach Carlisle and his staff the last 4 years, they do such a great job of the random conceptual things, the after play. But one of the constraints we did this year when we implemented these scratch screen concepts out of the corner was we're going to have the first couple of days, I think it was all roll to the rim. There's no, we're not ghosting out. We're rolling everything to the rim because players are going to naturally probably want to gravitate towards a go screen and maybe try to get a catch and shoot three, especially if it's a guard coming out of that corner. So those are just some of the reads, reading the defenders if they're opening up, looking to ghost out. If they're going to stay square on the ball, looking to get a hit, and we want pressure on the rim. More, in my opinion, more rolls than go screens, especially early on. And that can be done in a constraint setting as well.
So one of the common things to avoid is obviously the pass to the dead corner with no advantage. So
Yeah.
this helps counter that. Can you talk to us a little bit about teaching this initially? Because again, the concept in itself, love it. I can imagine initially there's a lot of freeze moments where either player's not sure when it's coming or how it's coming. So from your experience, how can we counter that?
Yeah, in terms of the install.
The scratch screen install, yeah.
Yeah, so what I've always liked to do is really just simplify. We're gonna drill it first, meaning literally I was just watching some old practice of us in training camp last year. We started with just the slot to slot pass on the air. There was no defense. It's just two on air, I like to call it. We're just going slot to slot and airtime of the pass. You're coming out and you're making that roll screen to the rim, airtime of the pass. So that would be our first initial step. Drill it and then rep it, meaning now we're going to add a dummy defense. So now slot to slot, we know there's no opportunity for a swing in the corner. So you've got to find action. You got to activate the corner. And now the drill it portion was on air. Now the rep it portion would be having a coach on the ball, and that coach is either staying square or looking to switch out and open his hips early. And that's going to be the rep it portion. That's going to be how we can layer this read, meaning when to ghost, when to get on the rim, and the timing of it all, airtime of the pass, the doorstep screen. And then the third approach would be play it. So we really want to drill it, rep it. Now we're going to play 2-on-2 live. Now they have. The defense can stay with their own. We may have them switching now. We have them staying with their own. So that's going to trigger different looks and different screening angles. And within that play it, we can add our constraints. We can, hey, we're all roll to the rim, or we're all go screening out on these actions. So really the install for me was drill it, rep it, and then play it.
Love it. Great concept. And definitely part of the modern game is learning to play out of those corners in some effective
Yeah.
and advantage way. Love it. Also, I know you have a unique kind of approach to offensive install, which I assume is what you talked about, but talk to us about some of the small group work that you do.
Yeah, same kind of, I put the cart before the horse there, a little bit of the same concept, right? If we like to play a lot of the game, especially the pro game, is going to turn into some kind of three-man action, right? And when we look to play in space and all that, but when we get to our actions, a lot of it's three-man action. So we'll do a lot of our install in a three-man action. Let's say we're playing out of pistol, right? And we want to play out of that three-man action. Again, same concept. I view the drill it portion is what I call my time to talk and teach. hey, out of this pistol screen, we want all the screens set inside the 3-point line, free throw line extended. This is the technique. This is the hard line. This is where I need you to be, eliminating nuance. If you're just looking at, we're on a railroad track and this is where I need you to be, that would be the drill it portion. And then we'd go back to, again, the rep it portion of, some guys call it dummy D. We're going to give them exaggerated reads. Let's say we're playing out of the pistol and we're going to give them an exaggerated pocket read, or we're going to take away the pocket. They need to play to the throwback on the flare screen, and we're going to give them these exaggerated reads and reps. And then that's going to lead to the play it portion of throwing. Now we're live 3-on-3, and now you're making these reads in a real world situation. And again, you can always add those constraints to the play it portion. But again, it's really, I'm not smart enough to be complicated. So it's really a simple approach of, we're going to drill it, we're going to rep it, meaning a dummy defense look, and give them the reads, and then we're going to play it. And the big thing for me is with the offensive stuff, we like to be conceptual, right? And I think that's a bit of a trend, but it's okay to start out with, hey, this is what this needs to look like. This is the specificity of it. This is the railroad track of the play. And then when you get into that rep it portion, that's when you're able to really fine-tune the reads. And then the play it portion is them just making it live and getting a feel for it on their own.
Great example of the teaching process and a great example of obviously helping players become the CEO of their own development. And I got to keep you here for one last one, Justin, and that's you're the founder of the Native American Basketball Coaches Association. So talk to us about that, your role in that, but also the coaching mentorship that I know you value.
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that. Yeah, it's something near and dear to my heart. I was born and raised on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Montana, and I'm proud of where I'm from and who I am. And it's something that kind of came to light in terms of you know this by talking to so many coaches. In a rural setting, it's sometimes hard to go watch a college practice when a lot of reservations and Indian country are in rural settings. And just based on talking to the folks I know, coaches I know from where I'm from, just having access to some clinics, having access to being able to go watch an NBA practice or a Division I practice, it's just not realistic in some of those areas. So that's really the spark of all this, was just to provide some resources. And again, not only it's obviously where I'm from and it's near and dear, but that's really helped shape me in who I am. You know what I mean? Culture is a big word in the coaching industry, but culture is a bit of a more powerful word in terms of where I'm from and growing up in Indian country. So it's shaped a lot of the way I coach and a lot of way I try to lead. It's a way I think I can maybe give back and maybe hopefully provide more representation of Native American coaches. And it's at the grassroots level. We're working really hard, but it's been really fun. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about that.
That's tremendous stuff. And any of us coaches like myself that have spent any time around natives playing basketball, you know it's one of those passion points for them. And it's just incredible
Yeah.
how they embrace basketball and love it. And
Yeah. It's really, if you haven't, it's really a religion in Indian country. And one of the things I've always, a spark that really hit me one time was, it's probably 15 years ago, and you may have a better understanding than when you first started really hearing the term positionless basketball, right? Maybe a little longer, but about 15 years ago is when I first started hearing that, positionless basketball. And what first hit me was, that's how I grew up playing on the reservation. You know what I mean? We didn't have positions. We've been playing that way in Indian country for a long time in terms of positionless basketball, offering a five-out approach, a fast-paced style. So that's one of the things that I'm always kind of tongue-in-cheek kind of proud of, is the trend of the pace and the trend of the positionless is something that I think is you've seen in Native American basketball for a long time.
And the reasoning is because there's not a lot of variation in size necessarily in some of these
Right.
places, right? So it's like everyone
Right.
plays and everyone plays fast. And the pace is also what stood out when I was around that, just how fast some of these groups play. So it's awesome.
Yeah.
Justin, can't thank you enough. You've given us so much to be able to think about, and glad we finally got you on the podcast. Thank you for sharing the game with us.
Appreciate all you do, Chris. You provide a lot of lessons for folks. And the one thing I can say is I met you a while ago at, I think it was at a Bucks training camp almost 9 years ago. And you've always remained the same guy. You're always willing to give back. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you for saying that.